Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Matthew Griffiths of the University of Southern Mississippi, whose dreamy new book is New Orleans in Golden Age Postcards. Matthew Griffiths is an associate professor at the University of Southern Mississippi, where he teaches in the School of Library and Information Sciences. And he's a deltaologist. What's that, you ask? A student and collector of postcards. He has a huge collection, more than 3,000, and 1,000 of those are postcards of New Orleans. He's selected 300 of them to share in a beautiful new book, New Orleans in Golden Age Postcards, one of my very favorite books this season. Matthew Griffiths, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Now, I love that you began your collection with postcards of libraries specifically.
Yes. Well, it's a long story about how I got into postcards. I'll try and make it short. I was in my mid-20s. I was living in Toronto, and I was at a bookstore. I remember it was on Bathurst, or just off Bathurst Street, and there was a postcard of a place that I'd been in New York State before when I was a kid, Lake Placid, and it was in like a little tray for 25 cents. I think there were maybe 10 postcards there, and I purchased it, and I thought, oh, interesting. I'd always just taken for granted that postcards were a late 20th century thing. I had absolutely no idea the history that existed for postcards. So fast forward a couple years later, and I was living in London, Canada, London, Ontario, because I'm Canadian originally, and I was at a small town of about 6,000 or 7,000 people called St. Mary's, and they were having a local heritage festival, and there were all these local history enthusiasts and collectors that were in one of the meeting rooms of City Hall displaying their various collections, and several of them had these albums of vintage postcards, and that's when I saw vintage postcard views of this small town that I was getting to know because it was very close to where I lived at the time. And I just found them so enchanting. And then once I began to do graduate work, my master's and eventually a PhD in library science, my area of specialization was looking at the history of libraries as places and understanding the library buildings and the development and the evolution of modern library buildings as social architecture, understanding why they were designed the way they were as far as organizational purposes and controlling people, controlling perception, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the best ways for me to understand that evolution was just to begin collecting vintage postcards of library buildings because it just so happened that the golden age of the postcard coincided with the golden age of modern purpose-built public library buildings, and in most specifically, Carnegie libraries. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just collected those by the hundreds. I was just going through that collection the other day, actually.
What time period was that?
Some say that it began in 1898. That was the date of the Private Mailing Card Act. That's when it officially became legal for private commercial publishers, printers, to create cards separate from the postcards that had existed in the United States. That were federal cards that were, you know, you purchased those at the local post office, and those began in the 1870s. But 1898 was when the private or the commercial postcard industry began, and that ran until, well, it depends on whom you ask. some say it ended around 1912, 1913, just before the First World War. Others say it, and I'm of this group, others say it ended just after the First World War, because there was an attempt after the First World War when pre-war postage rates were restored. There was a bit of an attempt to revive that golden age, but it didn't. People had moved on by then. But most sources will tell you it's about 1898, 1900 to 1920.
Now, one of my favorite stories in this book is where you found your first New Orleans postcard, and it was pretty far afield and well-timed.
It was indeed. It was that was the summer of 2011, and I'd come down to New Orleans to give a paper at the conference of the American Library Association. I didn't find any postcards here because I wasn't necessarily looking. But then not long after getting back home, I was in my hometown of Peterborough, Ontario, Canada, and I was at, I don't want to say a junk store, but a thrift store, full of old things. And they had a bunch of postcards. One of them was a postcard of Audubon Place. And I'd seen that. I'd had vivid memories of being in the garden, seeing New Orleans for the first time, and in particular the Garden District. And I had to get it. I think it was $2 or something like that. And then I became more curious. I thought, well, you know, I'm collecting postcards of various subjects. There have to be New Orleans postcards too. And sure enough, you know, I began to look the usual places, and I found them. And for reasons unconnected to that, I found myself not long after that, in 2013, moving down here to begin my post here at Southern Miss, and that gave me an opportunity to indulge even further.
Uh-oh, you were on the road.
Yeah.
But I love that you had just been here and seen the city for yourself, so that postcard meant even more.
That was a happy coincidence by far.
That's very nice. I mean, but you're really interested in print culture overall. I mean, you teach courses in the history of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, you're thinking about this in a larger perspective and larger context, rather. So talk a little bit about print culture in New Orleans and who printed these postcards and where they were sold and what they meant in the marketing of the city in so many ways.
Postcards and boosterism kind of went hand in hand. And that's a good question. There's so much to talk about. It's going to be difficult for me to just sort of keep my focus narrowed. Boosterism and postcards went hand in hand everywhere, in large cities and small towns. And so in New Orleans, I wouldn't say the dominant majority of cards were produced by local, smaller publishers in terms of numbers. But I would say in terms of individual views, the smaller local publishers did more because they had access to, I know they had access to more photographs, period photographs of the city. And a lot of these local publishers were like bookstores and stationers and even department stores. And they would print these. They would manufacture their own view cards, views of New Orleans, the streets, the buildings, French Quarter, Mardi Gras. And they were marketed primarily to tourists. I make the point in the book just looking at the number of extant views of different subjects and themes of New Orleans, the French Quarter and Mardi Gras, vastly outweighing any other subject or theme, that most of these were for tourists. But locals loved them too. Mm-hmm. And that's because this was the first time, I mean, we take for granted now that not everyone, but many people, most of us, I'd say, carry around, you know, a camera in our pockets, you know, our smartphones. We can photograph anything we want to. And certainly we've had something, a similar convenience for a long time. I mean, point-and-shoot cameras meant for the average person have been around for ages now. But back then, photography and mass-produced images were still very much the domain of the people who could actually create and manufacture those cameras were very expensive. No one had their own personal camera. So this became, for locals, a great way to collect in these little pieces, these little rectangles, images of places that they knew. And also, you know, a whole culture developed around this. I mean, people, not everyone, but a great many, a lot of newspapers called this a fever, a craze, and people started collecting view cards of where they lived, view cards of places where perhaps relatives lived. They developed pen pals, people they'd never met, but they'd begin exchanging cards within the country, outside the country. It became a way for people to learn about faraway places because, I mean, even though we were talking earlier that postcards are very, there's a lot of diversity in postcards in terms of all the different kinds you can get. There are humor cards, there are religious cards, art cards, but view cards, actual photographic reproductions, albeit artificially colorized, the view cards of places, of cities and towns and monuments and buildings, these by far statistically, but the sales of view cards outweighed any other kind of card. And so it just became a way to, as I say in the book, commodify the landscape. And they were so cheap. They were affordable. People just went crazy for them. And that so that and it became a very, very popular middle-class pastime, especially between the years 1900 and 1913, 1914.
And there were those panoramas where you would have like six postcards and you would unfold it.
I mean, and it is. This is not a criticism of my publisher, UPM. I actually told them, I said, don't. It'd be cost prohibitive to do a gatefold or a foldout. But that one panorama in the in chapter three of the Canal Street, looking down Canal Street from the top of the hotel. That one, I had to put in the description that I'd for space reasons I chopped it in half. But that thing unfolds. But it's four panels, and those are especially rare. The three panel ones are a little easier to find. A lot of the panoramas didn't survive.
Well, they're fragile too. Yeah. That's the other thing, and they seem to have such a special beauty. You know, there's such a style to them. Those dreamy colors. Those fonts in the captions.
Yes.
Even the handwriting and the messages when we see them seems of another time.
Yeah, well, the views themselves romanticized their subjects. And I think there's also, you know, looking back from the perspective of 100 years later, there's also a sort of a romanticization of the postcards as historical artifacts. That operates on several levels, at least for me.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with Matthew Griffiths, whose dreamy new book is New Orleans in Golden Age Postcards. I love how you gently educate us about how to look, the make of a car, or the style of a dress, for example, the direction of the view. And you make a point as you go by image of telling us what happened to those views we can no longer see today.
Well, thank you for pointing that out. I worked on this book for about 3 years. In the first 8 months or so, even before I submitted the proposed publisher, I just kept throwing away drafts because I didn't want this to be an academic work. I wanted it to be, you know, for readers of serious nonfiction, obviously for lovers of postcard history and New Orleans history, or even just people who love New Orleans of the present, want to learn more about the past. But it, you know, working on this book for me was a process of getting my head out of writing as an academic, which I'd done for many years up to that point. And I want to put this delicately. Academic writing is, in my opinion anyway, it's overly arcane. And it could be more engaging. Academic writing could be more engaging. Its style could be simpler. But I think there's a habit in the academy to, you know, use very big words. So I had to unlearn that, and I also had to put myself in the shoes of my audience. You know, what are they going to want to know? And I came up with an approach for each card, or in some cases I write one description for a pair of cards, and that was, what are we seeing, and then why would it have been important in some way to end up, you know, depicted on a postcard 100 years ago? And then the third question is, what happened to this, especially if it's a place or a building? Is it still there? Does it still look the same? And it's a simple approach, but to actually do it took a lot more writing and a lot more research than I thought it would. I predicted it would take me about maybe a year and a half to write the book. It took me 3 years.
Oh, also. No. It shows. Yeah. It shows a lot of work. And there are these sentences that they're just so wonderful. Like, one of my favorites is, of all plantations nearest New Orleans, the Three Oaks Plantation was the most postcarded. It's just...
Yeah, and it's an odd thing to hear that word used.
Yeah.
But it's an actual word. Other postcard historians have used it to describe something as being postcarded. But that was, it describes an important process, because if you lived in a small town, I mean, maybe we're taking for granted here because New Orleans is a large city, but even the smallest towns, even hamlets, eventually got postcarded. And that was such a badge of merit for a place,
right,
to be postcarded. And so that's a part of the culture, too.
So did you do a lot of walking around holding?
Yes. But because of the time involved, I had to make very specific agendas and dedicated trips. I couldn't, my research trips were not, I couldn't integrate those trips with, recreational trips. But yeah, there were certain things where I had to go see for myself to verify. Of course, Google Earth and those kinds of tools are very useful too, but some things I had to see for myself.
Now, you've arranged this thematically. It's so much fun to look through this book. I can't say that often enough. You point out the particular beauties of New Orleans and things it has to offer, the gift of the river, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you realize what a photogenic city we live in.
Yes.
The spiritual life and religious places, heritage and traditions, and the postcards of Mardi Gras are exceptionally fun, of course.
Yes.
There's one. I wonder if you'd talk about, if you remember the message. It's a crowd on Canal Street, and someone sent it to a friend challenging them.
With the hat.
That's, yes,
the Mardi Gras section. Yeah. Yeah.
If you can pick me out of this crowd, you get a new hat.
That's right. That's correct. Yes. That's what the person wrote on the back. Now, and it's fun to read those inscriptions too. That's one of the things that when I began collecting postcards, I was always looking for the most pristine versions if I had the choice. The ones that were not disfigured by cancel stamps, that weren't written on. And it was only in the last 3 or 4 years of collecting the postcards generally, but New Orleans postcards specifically, I began to realize the value in the inscriptions, which is a little embarrassing to admit, because as someone who does historical research, of course, life writings, letters, journals, I mean, there's a wealth of information there. But I had my collector hat on, not my historian's hat on, a lot of the time in those early years of collecting, and I'd avoid those. But then I began to look for ones that had those inscriptions, because that just added another dimension, because someone used the card. And in many cases, the inscriptions on the backs of these cards have nothing to do with what's on the card. But sometimes those inscriptions do, and you realize that, it's 100 years, 100 or so years later, but you have this little piece of a life in motion, or life that was in motion from 100 years ago. And it's more than just a pretty picture. It's an artifact.
And it's so funny to see the messages that are written on the front of cards. And were there any messages, I'm curious, that moved you particularly? Or?
Well, there is the one of the Jesuits' chapel in the cemetery. I hadn't memorized it, but you could tell that the sender of that postcard was sending the card to someone who'd experienced some kind of loss. And, there's only so much you can fit on a postcard, so the sender had to keep it general. But I remember when I found that one, it was online, I purchased it. It wasn't until it arrived that I flipped it. I was able to flip it over and read the back. And, yeah, that gave me pause for obvious reasons. Because if I remember, I'm looking for the page where I actually transcribed that in the text. There's a suggestion that the person, the recipient of that card, lost a child. So, yeah, that one stands out for sure.
And I wonder if you have a favorite. Is there one postcard you're especially charmed by?
Yes. it's funny. I had a feeling that you'd ask me that, but in the snap of a finger, I knew which one it was. And that's the interior view of the old Carnegie Library at Lee's Circle. And that's just because my background is in the history of libraries as places. And that is, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful Carnegie Library buildings that ever stood anywhere in the United States. And it didn't always look like that. Its interior, like any building, it developed over time and was renovated. But that we see it there not long after it opened. And even though the colorization is artificial, it was probably someone's interpretation, a printer or a retoucher overseas, that didn't know what the interior really looked like. But it does give a somewhat realistic view anyway. It just brings it to life. And yeah, so that's my favorite. In at a close second, it'd be a tie among all the hotel postcards, because I have a separate series in my own collection.
Of hotels?
Just about grand hotels, the grand hotels of North America.
Oh, but that library looked so dreamy in that postcard, I have to say.
Yeah.
Just luxurious and like you'd want to spend hours there reading. Now, my favorite was the couple sitting on the crescent moon, peering down on Audubon Park, which I thought was so romantic and charming. And you said that was a whole series with that couple.
Yes, I have seen others, and they're rare. That one I get was one of the last ones I got, actually, before I had to sort of put my foot down and say, okay, enough collecting, finish up the writing. Another one that I have shows, I think the one that made the book is them looking down over Audubon Park. But there are others of that same couple looking down over Canal Street, places like that, the French Quarter. And obviously that's not meant to look realistic. There's an element of fantasy there. And there's another one, actually. I don't believe the one in Canal Street is them sitting on a moon. I think they're actually looking down over Canal Street from a hot air balloon.
Oh, how adorable. Yeah. Oh, you could have called this whole book Wish You Were Here. I mean,
I think someone else has actually used that for another book about postcards.
Oh.
It was an article, actually. It was Bernadette Lear's article about library postcards.
Oh.
So, and I know her a little bit. I didn't want to steal her title, but yeah, that would have been a good title for the book.
So now you're planning another book about New Orleans postcards?
Yeah, in the epilogue, in this book's epilogue, I mentioned that the cards that came after, I made the point early in the first, in the preface, that, you know, the cards that came afterward, it's all a matter of personal taste, but when I began the project, I mean, about one-third of my total New Orleans postcard collection comprises cards published from 1920 up to about 1950. And they're not the same thing. They're quite good for what they are, but they, you know, the quality of printing was different, the styles were different, et cetera, et cetera. And most other collectors of view cards that I've spoken to agree that the Golden Age is called the Golden Age for a reason. And I didn't plan to include any of those in this first book because they're from a different era. Personally, my opinion of them was that they're pretty, you know, disposable. They're not exciting to look at. But my opinion changed over the course of writing the book. I do have quite a few of them. And there is the possibility of doing another work that looks at them separately, that kind of picks up from when this book leaves off and looks at those separately. And also takes a look at the development, you know, how, in what ways do these cards depict New Orleans in a similar way as the Golden Age cards did, and in what ways has that process changed? And obviously the, you know, certain elements of the New Orleans landscape will have changed too, new places to write about, that sort of thing. Whether or not that will actually become a whole other book, that I'm not too sure about. I know that in this one I mentioned like a future volume. But I'm wondering, and I haven't spoken to the publisher about this, there may be an opportunity. I'm hoping maybe there might be an opportunity if the book is still in print in a few years to maybe do an updated edition where there's an additional chapter. That might be the best way to examine those. But again, there's always the possibility, too, maybe of doing a whole separate book. We'll have to see.
Well, I had so much fun with this book.
And much thanks also to the publisher, UPM. It wasn't so clear at first whether or not there'd be the budget to do full color. I did sort of impress upon them at the proposal stage. I said, you know, if it's going to be, if it must be black and white, let's, you know, reconsider the whole thing, because if you don't see these in their original color, they just don't have the same effect.
It's not the same at all.
In the end, it was full color, and I thank them for that because they understood the value of that, and they did such a wonderful job of designing the book and making it just a wonderful item to hold in your hands.
I'm
complimenting my own book, but I'm paying a compliment to the graphic designer.
Well,
great job.
They're well-deserved compliments in any case.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Matthew Griffiths of the University of Southern Mississippi, whose dreamy new book is New Orleans in Golden Age postcards. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate that very much.
Send me a penny postcard, sweetheart, from you sometime. Just say you're well and happy, and everything is fine. I know that you don't miss me, and I never cross your mind. Send me a penny postcard, please, if you have the time. Tell me that you're having fun and making lots of friends, and that you've just met someone and you're in love again. It won't stop me from praying that you will change your mind. Send me a penny postcard, please, if you have the time.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Lady Hubbard discusses her new novel, The Rib King, with novelist Jamie Attenberg, Tuesday, January 19th at 7, in a Zoom conversation sponsored by Octavia Books. Go to octaviabooks.com to register. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.